Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The economic lesson today goes a little something like this. You'll get to keep your job if you have one, probably, but you might not be able to get one if you don't. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. This is the Marketplace podcast for Thursday, the 9th of May. Glad you could be with us. And with the usual caveat that there are lies, damned lies, and statistics, today's economic offering from the Department of Labor would seem to indicate that we have reached another milestone in the climb back from the Great Recession. It comes in the form of something called the 4-week moving average of first-time unemployment claims, and that I know is a mouthful. But basically, it means there are fewer people applying for unemployment benefits, which is good. Now, however, comes the part where I say, but Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith takes it from there.
If you have a job, you can breathe a little easier about keeping it.
You are actually no more likely to get laid off now than you were before the recession started.
Heidi Shierholz is a labor market economist at the Economic Policy Institute. She says employers have cut most of the fat they can out of payrolls.
They don't need to lay off anyone, so they're holding on to their workforce.
Still, Shierholz says consumer demand hasn't risen fast enough for companies to expand.
The side of the equation that hasn't picked up yet in the labor market is hiring. Hiring is still extremely depressed.
Government figures show job postings are stagnant, and there's just one job for every three job seekers. Ken Goldstein is an economist at the Conference Board. He says that has big implications.
In terms of the overall growth in the economy, you know, we're wasting this labor resource because we can't put it to work.
Nearly 12 million people are out of work in the U.S. More than a third of them have been jobless for over 6 months.
I think the really big question is whether the recession has done permanent damage to the labor market.
Justin Wolfers is a professor of economics and public policy at the University of Michigan. He says the labor market is recovering very slowly, and that slowness could be eroding the quality of the workforce.
Has it knocked people out for so long that people have lost skills and lost hope and that there's a generation who'll never return back to the workforce?
We don't have an answer yet, but Wolfers says that's what's keeping economists and probably job seekers up at night. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith. For Marketplace.
Bangladesh is living up to its reputation as the most dangerous place in the world for workers in the clothing industry. There was another fire in a garment factory there. 8 people have been killed in a plant that makes polo shirts and underwear for Western retailers. That's on top of the building collapse that killed more than 900 Bangladeshis just a couple of weeks ago. Some American companies have decided to pull out of Bangladesh altogether. Others are keeping mum. Still, others plan to be more transparent about where their clothes are made and how. But that can be tricky, as Gigi Duban reports.
Before that tank top ever made it to the rack, chances are it's been through a really long supply chain. Fabric here, assembly there, finish and trim at another factory. Gary Chartier teaches law and business ethics at La Sierra University. He says that's sort of convenient for retailers when there's a tragedy like the one in Bangladesh.
Many companies, as we know, find ways to put many layers between, you know, retail operations and production operations so that they can claim that they're really not responsible for what goes on the ground.
So when a company claims on its website or on a label that a T-shirt was made in a certain country, that doesn't always tell the whole story. Renee Bowers is executive director of the Fair Trade Federation. She says unless companies cut out the middlemen, it's almost impossible to know where and how a product is made.
And so with a shortened supply chain, there is a much greater level of transparency about workplace conditions, about pricing, and about who is making the product.
But is that practical for a retail giant like Walmart or Sears? Bowers says it won't be easy.
Yes, it is much more difficult to have a shorter supply chain. It is much more difficult to have direct partnerships. And it is very difficult for companies to provide the level of transparency that's going to help ensure workplace protections.
And even if companies do try to improve workplace conditions abroad, that costs money. And Gary Chartier says higher prices might turn some customers away.
While consumers are going to probably stay away from brands that they clearly identify with egregious abuses, apart from that, most consumers are probably going to be pretty responsive to price.
But he says for those customers who do care about product sourcing, more transparency will go a long way. I'm Gigi Duban for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, nothing doing. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Most people in the United States who have health insurance get it through work. But for the working poor, it's a whole different deal. Many of them don't make enough to buy the insurance that's offered by their employers, and yet they make too much to qualify for Medicaid. Obamacare and the expansion of Medicaid it will bring in some states could cover more of the working poor. But in other states, like Tennessee, it won't. From WPLN, Blake Farmer reports.
Amanda Smith is just off the clock from her manufacturing job assembling car doors at the M-Tech factory in Manchester. Clear safety glasses are still perched on her head as she walks into Partners for Healing, a free clinic.
It boils down to I've got problems as a woman, and I've went to the hospital over and over, and they look at you like you're just there to get pain medicine and stuff like that these days.
Smith says she has never had insurance, ever. And yet, she's always worked. But making $9 an hour with an unemployed husband and two sons, Smith can't even think of paying for the expensive coverage through her employer. And because she's married and has a steady job, she doesn't qualify for the state's Medicaid program. But she might if it were expanded.
When you've already got medical coming in that you can't even afford, and you got bill collectors coming after you over medical that you can't afford, and you can't get state help otherwise of your income. I mean, I don't know what else to say.
So like many people in her situation, Smith has turned to charity.
As soon as you get all that stuff back, it takes me usually about a week.
Okay.
They'll get to you, okay?
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Partners for Healing offers care solely to the working uninsured, and there are plenty of them in places like Tullahoma, Tennessee, a town of 18,000. There's no shortage of studies showing rural Americans are more likely to have low-wage jobs and thus have no insurance.
You've got people trying, and they're working hard, and they're hard workers.
Belle Royton is one of the registered nurses who run this clinic. She says many patients make barely enough to feed their families.
I've seen our practitioner write out a script. It was $7 or $10, and the patient just looked at us and said, I don't have that money for another 2 weeks. It just might as well have been $1,000.
When a few dollars is too much, the uninsured often turn to the emergency room, where they can't be turned away, even if they don't have insurance.
That doesn't get asked until well beyond the registration area.
Phil Young heads Southern Tennessee Medical Center in the town of Winchester. It's the only hospital for two rural counties, and Young is facing some tough decisions. Like many hospitals, Young's was banking on Medicaid expansion to bring in more paying customers. Healthcare reform has already taken a bite out of reimbursements, and the sequester is bringing more financial pain.
Those two cuts to Southern Tennessee equals the salaries, wages, and benefits of one-third of our registered nurses in the hospital. Those are not small numbers.
A recent survey found that more than a third of Tennessee's hospitals are already in such dire straits they could close if the state doesn't expand Medicaid to cover more poor people. For cities, that could mean one or two fewer facilities. But in the country, that could mean losing the only hospital within an hour's drive. Craig Becker heads the Tennessee Hospital Association.
Frankly, the way things are going, it's not looking good for a lot of our, particularly our small and rural, high uncompensated care hospitals.
Tennessee is a Republican state, and it's kept the door to Medicaid expansion open. But so far, the peril of hospitals and the state's working poor haven't convinced politicians to go along. In Tullahoma, Tennessee, I'm Blake Farmer for Marketplace.
We saw a piece in the Washington Post the other day that intrigued us, a thought experiment of sorts by a professor down at Duke University. What would happen, he supposed, if all the millionaires in government, Congress, the president, and the Supreme Court, got together and formed their own political party, just for millionaires, mind you. Nicholas Carnes is said professor. He crunched the numbers down at Duke. He teaches public policy there. Nick, good to have you with us.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
Give me a sense of context here, would you? If millionaires in government got together, how much, influence, right, would that party have?
Well, so if millionaires were a political party, they would make up less than 10% of the country, but they would have a supermajority in the U.S. Senate. Hmm. They would have a majority in the House, 5-4 on the Supreme Court, and a man in the White House. It would have unified control of the federal government. It would have a lot of sway in Washington.
Seems to me, then, that this makes Congress, because it has all these millionaires, Congress is a different body than it would otherwise be, right?
Absolutely. So in my research, I try to simulate, well, what would Congress do if it were made up of the same mix of social classes as the country as a whole? And, you know, if you sort of reweight members based on how they actually voted and say, well, what if we give the very few who are from the working class lots of votes? Does Congress still pass the same number of policies? And the answer is no. A Congress that looks like the country as a whole is going to be a lot less enthusiastic about policies that help the rich at the expense of the poor and a lot more enthusiastic about pro-worker, pro-lower-income policies.
Can you quantify it a little bit? Like how many more progressive types of bills might we have?
Well, it's hard to know exactly because we never really see a Congress that has lots of working class people in it. But if you go down to the state or even the city level and you start saying, well, what do they do differently? I mean, I can tell you they spend a much bigger proportion of their budgets on social safety net programs. Economic inequality is lower in places where the legislature looks more like the state as a whole and less like the state's country clubs.
Mm-hmm. Has it always been thus?
If you go back to 1901, way before Citizens United, way before the decline of organized labor, Congress is still less than 2% working class. Huh. Flash forward to today, Congress is still less than 2% working class. Our political process has for a long time been dominated by the affluent, by white collar professionals, by wealthy individuals.
Yeah. Leaving aside for just a second that nobody in Congress, millionaire or otherwise, can seem to agree on you know, like when to shampoo the carpets in the House and Senate chamber. You're lumping like Daryl Issa from the GOP in the House with, you know, who's the richest guy in the Senate? I don't even know. Jay Rockefeller maybe in the Senate, right? A Democrat and a Republican. Do rich people band together in politics?
Rich people, they do tend to think differently. And this is not to say that they're doing anything wrong. There's tons of diversity of political perspective within the very wealthy or within white-collar professionals. But the average white-collar professional still thinks differently about things like the minimum wage than the average blue-collar worker. When you have political institutions that completely exclude whole classes of Americans, you're going to get a tilted or a slanted take on how the government should be involved in economic affairs.
Nick Carnes. He's a professor of public policy at Duke. He's got a book coming out on the topic at hand. It's called White Collar Government, The Hidden Role of Class in Economic Policymaking. Nick, thanks a bunch.
Thanks so much for having me.
Coming up, 501s and football.
Silicon Valley's a center of innovation and some really cool folk. And it's a center where a lot of people wear a lot of jeans.
We'll make it make sense for you. But first, let's do the numbers. Yeah, so much for all that exhausting record setting, huh? The Dow Industrial slipped to 10% today, 22 points, closed at 15,082. The NASDAQ also gave back about a 10%, 4 points, finished at 3,409. The S&P 500 tossed off 3%, 0.3%, rather, 7 points, ended at 1,626. Financial firms paired up for losses today. Citigroup reversed 1 4/10%, so did JPMorgan Chase. Goldman Sachs gave back 1%. Morgan Stanley did the same thing. The rumor mill churned out a huge day for Barnes & Noble today. It booked a 24% gain on reports that Microsoft might snap up its Nook business for a cool billion simoleons. Facebook couldn't say the same. Rumors that it's in talks to buy Waze, or Waz, I don't even know, a mobile driving app, sent Facebook shares down 0.3% today. Hold off on that obit for Groupon, everybody. Shares in the daily deal site soared 11% today on yesterday's strong quarterly earnings report. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.81%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace Music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. In Washington, a look at the nation's balance sheet. The Treasury Department issues its monthly statement for April. It's where you stuff all your stuff. The company Public Storage releases quarterly earnings. And it's a day set aside to honor those married to the nation's men and women in uniform. Tomorrow is Military Spouse Appreciation Day. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. All right, so first we had Take Your Daughter to Work Day. That turned into Take Your Child to Work Day. Now we have, thanks to Google, Take Your Parents to Work Day. The company's Silicon Valley campus is crawling with moms and dads. Today they are taking yoga classes, sitting in on workshops, and probably trying to understand just what it is their kids do between gorging on all the free food and playing foosball to earn a paycheck at that company. Marketplace's Queenie Kim explains, it's the Valley.
Stacey Sullivan is Google's chief culture officer. She says there's been so much focus on the perks at Google, the free food, the sleeping pods where Googlers can nap, that she gets a lot of this.
You have the best job in the world. All you do is eat really good food and have, you know, massage and pet dogs, right?
Michael Rubens is the father of a 28-year-old Googler. Rubens flew out from New York to attend the event with his son.
Well, we're trying to understand what he's doing.
Actually, it's not that complicated. His son works in communications. The idea of bringing your family to work isn't new. Charles O'Reilly is a professor at Stanford's Graduate School of Business. He says studies have shown that employees are more committed to their jobs when their work environment is family-friendly and relatives know something about what they do.
What they're trying to do at Google, obviously, is to do that, but recognizing that the majority of their employees are probably young enough that rather than having kids, they have parents.
He says Parents' Day speaks to what's unique about Silicon Valley's workforce. It's really young. The average age at Google is around 29, according to PayScale, an employment research company. So rather than a spouse and kids, the nuclear family for many techies is still mom and dad. Neil Hartman is a lecturer at MIT's Sloan School of Management. He says Parents' Day could also be a very subtle way of retaining employees, something tech companies are obsessed with these days.
You can imagine if your son or daughter came to you and said, you know, well, I'm thinking of leaving Google. Their reaction initially is probably going to be, are you crazy?
He says when you're young, you don't always have the experience to appreciate what you've got. And that's what mom and dad are for. In San Francisco, I'm Queenie Kim for Marketplace.
After what seems like months, but really has probably only been weeks of ads and billboards and television commercials, The Great Gatsby will be upon us tomorrow. Director Baz Luhrmann has always been a more is more kind of director, so a story about rich people partying through the jazz age is right up his alley. But at a time when a lot of people have a lot of anxiety about the rich leaving the rest behind, what's a movie like this actually saying? From the Wealth and Poverty Desk, Noelle King has the story.
I'm sitting on top of the world. I'm rolling along. Yes, rolling along.
Born poor, Jay Gatsby made his way to the top of the world. Here's a clip from the movie trailer.
A king to a guy.
I live in all the capitals of Europe, collecting jewels, hunting big game, painting a little.
You don't believe me.
Like today, some people in the roaring 20s were getting really rich. More were left behind. New York Times chief film critic Tony Scott says this film kind of fetishizes wealth.
It's like if you took every image, you know, in a luxury fashion magazine and scrambled them all together and blew them up to big screen size and put them in 3D and filled them with movie stars and a big soundtrack. It's like the most awesome commercial that you've ever seen.
But the film's poor?
They're meant to be pitied, but at the same time, they're so abject and so grotesque. No one, I think, can watch this movie, whatever their own circumstances, and identify comfortably with the poor characters in it.
F. Scott Fitzgerald's book warned against the pursuit of money. Scott says the new movie may be making a different point.
You know, we're living in a time of great inequality and high unemployment and a persistent economic malaise. But at the same time, we seem to be living in a gilded age. The rich get richer and richer and richer.
Maybe that paradox is why, even as Gatsby storms into theaters, in some of this year's most highly anticipated movies,
Happy Hunger Games!
Poor people are the good guys, like the Hunger Games sequel, or Elysium, where the rich live on a luxurious space station while the rest of us hack it out on a ruined Earth. It seems like there are a lot of these movies lately. Is our post-recession anxiety over money making its way onto the big screen? I met Michael Bolas of the L.A. Film School on Hollywood's Walk of Fame, where we pass the names of actors famous and forgotten.
Brian Dunleavy, Colleen Moore, Bill Keane.
Ah, there's John Wayne.
Bolas says we might think we're seeing more wealth and class conflict, but film was born in another century's gilded age, and these are plots that the early directors and studios lifted from books and plays.
The hyper-wealthy, oligarchs, plutocrats, suppressing and oppressing the lower class.
Then, like now, we may resent the wealthy, but we also want to be them. So in the movies, whether it's A Wonderful Life...
To my big brother George... The richest man in town.
Or Wall Street.
The point is, ladies and gentlemen, that greed, for lack of a better word, is good.
The desire for wealth and conflicts over it have made for great plots again and again, and they will again and again. Maybe Gatsby's narrator, Nick Carraway, said it best. So we beat on, boats against the current, borne back ceaselessly into the past. I'm Noel King for Marketplace.
The San Francisco 49ers announced their latest corporate partnership today. It's a biggie, $220 million over the next 20 years from Levi Strauss, the Blue Jeans people. In return, starting in the 2014 season, the Niners will be playing at the brand new Levi's Stadium. One is obliged to ask, though, and apologies in advance, whether this deal is a good fit. Deborah Kay is a partner at the consulting firm Lucule. Deborah, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
So I'll be honest with you. I wasn't expecting Levi's and the 49er Stadium, although there is a certain historic charm, what with the gold rush and all. I was expecting, like, you know, Google or one of those high-tech companies out in Silicon Valley, right?
Well, I think most companies realize today that putting your name on a stadium doesn't get you much value for it.
So then why is Levi spending $220-some-odd million over 20 years?
Well, I think what they're thinking is that, you know, their brand's lost a little bit of its luster. Silicon Valley's a center of innovation and some really cool folk. And it's the center where a lot of people wear a lot of jeans. So if I get a lot of cool folk really wearing a lot of my jeans who are, you know, getting on a lot of airplanes and stuff like that, maybe I can get some cultural mojo going for my jeans.
Yeah, mojo, right? But here's the thing. I mean, history is littered with examples of naming rights deals gone bad. I only need to mention the Enron Stadium, wherever the heck that was down in Texas. And, you know, we had the Kodak Theater here when Kodak went bust. I mean, come on.
Well, I agree with you. I think it's kind of risky, but I think that what's really happened here is you've got two brands that really come from that area and probably some good government officials who kind of said, come on, guys, we got to put something together here.
This is not a huge financial risk for Levi's. I mean, yes, it's a lot of money, but they made $4.6 billion in revenues last year. So $220 million is not bad. But are they going to get their money's worth, do you think?
If you think about all the times that it's going to be viewed on TV, in terms of when they pan on all the TV, you know, on all the games, yes, they'll probably get their money's worth in terms of TV impressions.
Yeah.
But will those TV impressions turn into any sales? Doubtful.
But do they work? I mean, do they do that brand awareness thing? Do they raise the profile as much as you'd think?
You know, and today, just putting your name out there really doesn't work in general.
Yeah.
What people really want is involvement with the brand and engagement with the brand. And so brands are really going to be a lot better if they figure out ways that people can have some sort of creative engagement with the brand.
As you may or may not know, we're working on a thing to rename our conference rooms here at Marketplace. We're running a little thing. And let me just parenthetically say, if you've got ideas, send them to us, letters@marketplace.org, or you can tweet at us.
I think the Kai Suite sounds pretty good. Kai Suite,
that's not bad. I hadn't heard that one. That's not bad. Which, of course, guarantees it will lose. Deborah Kay, she's at Luke Kuehl. Deborah, thanks very much.
Thank you so much.
Our conference room sweepstakes, by the way, got a whole bunch of responses from you yesterday. Supply and demand was very popular. Main Street, Wall Street as well. Also, bacon and sausage, but I don't really know what that one's about. I'm not going to tell you my favorite, but you can vote for yours at marketplace.org. We've got a poll set up. Catches, you got to do it by tomorrow at 2 o'clock Eastern Time. We will tell you the winner on the broadcast tomorrow.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, which is A, kind of wild, and B, a cautionary tale of sorts, I guess. The New York Times reported this afternoon on a bank heist that boggles the mind. It was a cyber heist, really, that went on for months. The bad guys hacked into accounts, transferred a bunch of money around, and then, in Manhattan alone in one day, hit 2,000 ATMs and withdrew $2.5 million. Total take worldwide over the whole thing was $45 million. The best line from the story in the Times today: surveillance photos of one suspect hitting various ATMs showed his backpack getting heavier and heavier. You can kind of see that one, right? Okay. We're done. That's Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow off a 10%, 22 points. The NASDAQ gave back a 10th as well, 4 points. The S&P 500 lost 0.3%. That is 7 points. John Buckley, Kim Bowie, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, George Judson, Jonathan Karp, Ethan Lindsay, Betsy Streisand, and Celeste Wesson are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is Sarah Gilbert. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you back here tomorrow, everybody. And this is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.